The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt, broadcasting from the Sunshine State today to all the United States and wherever you are. It's good to have you. Morning glory, United States, and bonjour, hi, Canada. It's an amazing thing to watch local news here in Florida because they are, of course, paying much more attention to the uprising in Cuba than anywhere else in the United States. I want to begin with President Biden's remarks. I'm glad he made them at the White House yesterday in a press spray. Cut number three.
Taking place in Cuba. The Cuban people demanding their freedom from an authoritarian regime. And I don't think we've seen anything like this protest in a long, long time, if quite frankly ever. The United States stands firmly with the people of Cuba as they assert their universal rights. And we call on the government of Cuba to refrain from violence and their attempts to silence the voice of the people of Cuba. And we're also closely following the developments in Haiti in the wake of the horrific assassination of the president that recently took place. The people of Haiti deserve peace and security, and Haiti's political leaders need to come together for the good of their country. Over the weekend, I dispatched a high-level expert delegation to assess the situation.
This is it on Haiti. President Miguel Diaz-Canel, went to the television by contrast to President Biden and urged his thugs to take to the streets and the revolutionaries to take to the streets. Now, I assume that there are between 1% and 5% of the population that depend upon the party's violence to get their food. People are starving to death down there. Anthony Blinken responded to Diaz-Canel's assertion that the United States were behind the uprising yesterday as well. The Secretary of State, cut number two.
The policy review that you point to focuses on the political and economic well-being of the Cuban people. And obviously we're looking carefully and closely at what has just happened, what indeed is happening. And as we've stated many times, at the heart of the review and at the heart of the policy that will result are democracy and human rights. That's core to our efforts. That will be reflected in the policy. I think it would be a grievous mistake for the Cuban regime to interpret what is happening in dozens of towns and cities across the island as the result or product of anything the United States has done. It would be a grievous mistake because it would show that they simply are not hearing the voices and will of the Cuban people. People deeply, deeply, deeply tired of the repression that has gone on for far too long. Tired of the mismanagement of the Cuban economy. Tired of the lack of adequate food and, of course, an adequate response to the COVID pandemic. That is what we are hearing and seeing in Cuba. And that is a reflection of the Cuban people.
That is not Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall. Neither the president nor the Secretary of State said, Diaz-Canel, free your people, or anything remotely like it. Marco Rubio on the Senate floor began to speak for America and for Cuban Americans. Cut number one.
Well, that's what's happened in Cuba. Socialism and Marxism has done in Cuba what it has done everywhere in the world that it's been tried. It has failed. It has failed. They gave up their freedom, or they were told, give up your freedom in exchange for a world-class healthcare system. It's not a world-class healthcare system. In fact, it's a healthcare system that does not even have the ability to deal with COVID at its very basic level. That says, give up your freedom for economic security. What economic security? People are hungry. Homes are crumbling. There is no economy. There is no real economy in Cuba. Give up your freedom and you'll have an education, free education for everybody. That education, number one, you're a doctor. You can drive a taxi cab in Cuba and make more money. Or number two, you get sent, forced to go overseas and work basically on slave wages, no pay, barely any pay at all. It's basically human trafficking, as our own Department of State found when it looked at the Cuban doctors program and how it's been abused. And so what's happened in Cuba is socialism has failed. It has to repress the people who complain about it. You don't get your freedom back. And like socialists always do, they have to find someone to blame. And who do they blame? Number one, they blame anybody in the country that doesn't agree with them. You're immediately a counter-revolutionary. You're immediately a pawn of the imperialists. And then, of course, they always blame the United States. The problem in Cuba for the regime is the people aren't falling for those lies anymore. They're not.
Senator Rubio was speaking, I think, for the Cuban people yesterday. And all over the media, there was an incredible failure to cover this. The only good report I saw was by Andrea Mitchell of NBC News on Lester Holt's program last night. Barely made. This is a potentially turn of history moment, 90 miles from Key West. And our national news media isn't covering. Now, we have reporters there. They're not venturing into the countryside. They are not doing Arab Spring, Ukrainian revolution, Lebanon revolution. They're not covering the revolution. They're cowering. And they may be doing so under threat of violence, but they're not reporting that. And if they don't have freedom of movement, they ought to get out of the country and declare that they don't have freedom of movement. The New York Times did run a good story. I want to praise Oscar Lopez and Ernesto Londono. Hospitals and pharmacies have run out of medicines as basic as penicillin and aspirin. Blackouts have become maddeningly frequent and agonizingly long. Cubans lucky enough to have foreign currency wait in line for hours for staples like beans and rice. A searing economic decline leading to hardships Cubans have rarely seen since the collapse of the Soviet Union devastated their country in the 1990s has stirred the island's largest protest in decades, eliciting a chorus of support from American politicians and angry threat from Cuba's government. We stand with the Cuban people in their clarion call for freedom. That's what President Biden said in a written statement as he stumbled through trying to read something like it in the meeting yesterday. Citing what the president called decades of repression and economic suffering to which they have been subjected by Cuba's authoritarian regime. His comments followed an astonishing wave of demonstrations on Sunday when thousands took to the street against the nation, shouting phrases like freedom and homeland and life. A twist on the governing Communist Party's motto, homeland or death. Protesters overturned a police car, looted a government-run store, acts of open defiance shared widely online in a nation with a long and ruthlessly effective history of quashing dissent. Cuba's President Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez, the first person outside of the Castro family to lead the country since the Cuban Revolution more than 60 years ago, has cast the outpouring as an existential threat. They'll have to walk over our dead bodies if they want to take on the revolution, he said in remarks prominently displayed on the front page of the Cuban Communist Party Granma on Monday. We're willing to do everything and we'll be on the streets battling. But even he had to acknowledge the severity of the nation's problems, saying on Monday that he understood how trying the past few months have been for Cubans. He pleaded for their patience while also calling the demonstrations the product of an underhanded campaign by Washington to exploit people's emotions at a time when the island is facing food scarcity, power cuts, and a growing number of COVID-19 deaths. We must make clear, he said, to our people that one can be dissatisfied. That's legitimate, but we must be able to see clearly where we're being manipulated, Díaz-Canel said. They want a change to the system to impose what type of government in Cuba? How about a free one? Biden's remarks, which flatly called the Cuban government authoritarian regime, it's a totalitarian regime, it's not authoritarian, I doubt the president knows that, marked a notable shift in tone from the position advanced by former President Barack Obama. He was buddy-buddy with Fidel. And when Fidel died, his right arm, Ben Rhodes, flew down to the memorial service. I want you to remember that. Mr. Obama made restoring relations. By the way, you got to remember as well that Raphael Warnock is buddy-buddy with Castro as well. The senator from Georgia who got elected in the runoff, who's up in 2 years. Buddy-buddy. He issued a statement yesterday saying something, blah, 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 Cuban people. He is buddy-buddy with Fidel when Fidel came to the United States. Mr. Obama made restoring relations a focal point of his foreign policy. Of course he did. It is time to free Cuba. and to the media out there, get out there and do your jobs. And on Twitter, keep retweeting everything from hashtag Cuba SOS, hashtag Cuba Libre. Let people know that you are on their side. And Senator Rubio will be joining me a little bit later on today's show, as will some of the regular guests. Don't go anywhere, America. We come back. I'll update you on Larry Elder running for governor in California. Follow him on Twitter at Larry Elder. Of course, I am neutral. I'm going to moderate debates at the Nixon Library later this summer. But Larry Elder is in the game, in the hunt in California. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. That music means David Drucker, the Washington Examiner, joins me. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. How's Orlando?
It is terrific. I want to ask you how the reconciliation debate is working out. I'm focused on Cuba. There's not much to report there that I haven't already reported, but I know that Bernie is dropping his reconciliation outline today, I think.
Yeah, look, I mean, this thing one way or the other will work itself out. And then I think Democrats will end up gathering votes they need for some reconciliation vehicle. I think the question is, what's going to be in it? What are the dollar amounts going to be? Democrats are, I think, struggling to get some things done because they are, and I don't know if this is purposeful or not, but they're sort of treating this year and last year, and this year and next year, as if it's their only chance to do anything, and then it's all over. And that might be true in terms of the next midterm election, but you know, if they took a look at the size of their majorities, and in the Senate, of course, the majority only exists because of the tiebreaker. It's a 50-50 split. And they tried to pass legislation based on how the country actually voted in 2020. They might find themselves getting a lot more done. And I think they'd have a lot better chance of pulling off an upset in 2022. But they, you know, political parties these days, and, you know, we've talked about this with Republicans when it was their time up at bat, seem to be addicted to transformation and going as big and bold as possible. And they just simply don't have the votes. But they'll work something out. They'll pass some reconciliation vehicle. I just think we don't know yet what it's going to look like.
Do we have any idea what the tax package is? Because spending more money and throwing more money on the inflation bonfire is something Bernie's going to do. What will get blowback for even more members in the House and may create a Rock of Gibraltar obstacle are tax hikes in swing districts on people like stepped up basis. If they get rid of stepped up basis, they can kiss goodbye to the Virginia suburbs. You know, the only guy that's going to help is Glenn Youngkin, because half of the people in Virginia will get hit by that.
Right. So again, I think it sort of goes back to whether or not they're going to try and govern with an eye towards maintaining their control over some of these swing suburban districts. And I think that's up in the air, right? Because I think whenever, you know, what's become popular over the past few years, really longer than that, is the idea that tax increases in and of themselves are not necessarily problems with voters. The tax cuts are not necessarily big winners with voters. And so I think it's going to be in part about whether the Democrats that are in these districts put their foot down and say no. And by the way, whether they put their foot down and say we want to return of some of the tax benefits that we lost or our constituents lost with the mortgage tax deduction and SALT and all of that. Nancy Pelosi has 5 votes in the House. There are enough centrists or at least Democrats from these suburban swing districts such that if they put their foot down and said, no, not unless we get this or that, they could actually do some damage or, you know, work their will. It's just a question of whether they're going to do it.
Now, the way I understand the tax debate, the Republicans shot themselves in the foot. And I talked to Kevin Brady about this. I warned Paul Ryan. When they did away with SALT, they lost Orange County, California, because that was, if you live in a high tax state and you take away the state and local income tax deduction, the property tax deduction from your federal income taxes, you just lose suburbs. Democrats didn't take the hit for that. Republicans did. If Democrats take away stepped up basis and the working wealthy get hit, they're wealthy because of the value of their home. And they know all of a sudden what they work to accumulate for their kids is imperiled by 30 or 40%, whatever the cap's gain is. And it would be, I think, 43% adjusted in most states. they're going to get hammered. That's the thing I think, you know, they don't need to get salt back. They just can't do an unforced error like the Republicans did.
Well, I agree with that. And, you know, and I think that's, you know, one of the things that Republicans are still dealing with is that, you know, for a lot of suburban voters, they weren't Republicans for cultural reasons. They were Republicans for fiscal reasons. And when they lost some of that juice on the fiscal side for why they've been voting Republican, they didn't necessarily want to be a part of the coalition. And I, you know, I think for Democrats to solidify some of the gains they've made in the suburbs in 2018 and 2020, even though some of those seats did go back into the Republican Party, a lot of those seats held. If they want to solidify the trend, and we've seen a lot of this, particularly in suburban Dallas, suburban Houston, suburban Atlanta, they're going to have to take into account why, you know, what really motivates these voters. Education, law and order, crime issues motivate these voters, but fiscal issues, how you're taxed. It's not a very popular thing to say when I try and talk about this issue, but you just use the term, and it's very important, the working wealthy. These are people that, by all accounts, are doing extremely well. They have all the accoutrements of doing extremely well, but they have to work to maintain it. They're not independently wealthy, and the minute they get a major tax hit, or if somebody loses their job, or there's a change in an industry where they're earning a great living, all of a sudden it all goes away, and it's a big problem. And I don't think a lot of politicians understand that.
The working wealthy is what we used to call the upper middle class, and now they're the wealthy because they have a house that's worth $1 million, but it's not going to be worth $1 million in their death if the Democrats get their way. It's going to be worth $400,000. David Drucker, thank you, my friend. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show, hour two, straight ahead. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt in Florida at the Alliance Defending Freedom gathering to discuss where religious liberty is headed next year. I'll be joined by a couple of their lawyers later in the program. I'm joined now by Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Fox News. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well, thank you.
Byron, do you think media is doing its job in Cuba?
No. You mean the U.S. media?
U.S. media.
Of course not. Of course not.
I agree.
There was basically a story in the Babylon Bee of Bernie Sanders purportedly going down to Cuba to explain to Cubans why they should be happy with all of their social services. It's not so far off some of the media coverage.
Now, I watched a
it
good
was the
report
Babylon
by.
Bee. I should remind everybody. Okay.
Yeah. I watched a good report by Andrea Mitchell on Lester Holt's Nightly News last night. And it's a desert other than that. I mean, there's a little bit here and a little bit there showing some clips of video. And I'm wondering, we being the American media, covered the Arab Spring extensively, as I did on this radio show, as you did on Fox. We covered the Ukrainian Revolution, the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon. We even covered the Green Movement in Iran while President Obama studiously ignored it. Why not this? I mean, don't we have reporters all over Cuba?
And it's 90 miles from Key West. I mean, this is actually really extraordinary, but it does fit, obviously, into a long history of left-right politics in the United States. Obviously, the large numbers of Cubans who came to the United States in 1959, 60, 61, many of them eventually became Republicans, became quite conservative, became Ronald Reagan supporters. And that part of the Cuban community in Florida was viewed as a Republican conservative group. Meanwhile, there were lots of intellectuals and people in the press on the left who essentially sympathized with what Fidel Castro had done. They talked endlessly about free health care available in Cuba, as if somehow that created a quality of life in a country that was not free. So there's been this divide always. So I'm not really surprised to see it continue. You saw it continue through the death of Fidel Castro, then the ascension of his elderly brother Raul Castro. I mean, and so you're seeing it still.
Now, I do believe that there's an appetite in the American public for freedom in Cuba to watch it unfold, and that networks are going to get punished again. They can't get punished much more. The ratings have collapsed utterly on cable news. And part of the effect in the election of 2020 was a significant uptick in President Trump and Republicans generally appeal among Latinos. I think that has something to do far beyond Cuba and Venezuela, but also just generally with the Latino demographic in the United States being more pro-freedom than had previously been thought by the Democratic consulting class.
Well, so much of analysis, mainstream analysis of the Latino vote in the United States had been based on the question of immigration, with the idea that Latino voters would, of course, support more illegal immigration because they just would. Well, it was absolutely untrue. It was absolutely untrue. And I will say this has been a Republican problem, a Republican fixation. Remember 2012, Mitt Romney doesn't do well among Hispanic voters. The party does the so-called autopsy after Romney's loss, and they come out and say, we are not going to make any policy recommendations in the autopsy. And they break their rule. They make one policy recommendation, which is to try to win more Latino votes. And if I may go on a little hobby horse here, the secret to winning Latino votes is campaigning in areas where there are Latino voters. If you show up, deliver your message, not a pandered message, not a message tailored to them, your basic Republican conservative campaign message, you'll do fine. And I think Trump did that somewhat. He did well in you know, obviously he won Florida both times, won it more decisively the second time around than the first.
Yeah, and I believe that's going to repeat. I do think immigration ought to be dealt with generously, but it's not the killer of Latino votes for Republicans that Democrats wish it were. Let me ask you about something I just talked about with your colleague at the Examiner, David Drucker, about Byron. That is that in the tax bill under Paul Ryan, against my and other people's warnings, they did away with the state and local income tax deduction, self-inflicted wound, crushed their vote in places like Orange County, California, and suburbs everywhere where property taxes are high and home values are high. Now Democrats threaten to do away with stepped-up basis, which is aimed at what I call the working wealthy. And my definition is very simply this. If you own your own home and that home is valued at more than $500,000, you have a job and a retirement account, you are working wealthy by standards of anywhere in the world. And this tax cut aiming at stepped-up basis, or this tax hike that aims at stepped-up basis, is aimed at anyone who hits those three things. $500,000 house anywhere in the United States or more. You know, some people have $750,000, some $1 million. It depends on where you live, what's happened to the value of your house over 30 years. A retirement account that is, you know, healthy, and a job. You're the working wealthy in America, and the Democrats are coming for you.
Well, they have to. I mean, the thing that's been obvious about Democratic tax increase plans forever is that there's not enough money. There are not enough rich people to pay for them. You could confiscate the wealth. I'm not talking about the yearly income, the wealth of the top 1%. And you wouldn't pay off the national debt. And you wouldn't even hit the deficit that we have, the yearly deficit that we're having right now. So you can't finance these programs, not just the American Jobs Plan, the American Family Plan, being the two Joe Biden close to $6 trillion spending plans. You can't finance them by taxing the rich. The rich aren't rich enough to do that. So there are far, far more people in the middle class. So what you do is you start going down, down the income scale. And these are people, as you just described, people who are doing well. They're doing well in life. When you look at the median household income, they're far, far above that. So Democrats can convince themselves that these people are really rich and we can go after them. But the problem is when the spending plans become bigger and bigger and bigger, you have to go further down. And they will go further down below what you call the working wealthy right now in order to finance these plans because the rich aren't rich enough.
Then they'll go to the working affluent, because below the working wealthy are the working affluent. And by that, that means someone, again, home ownership is the key here. People who own homes are well off in this United States because of the cost of home going up, up, up. People who have retirement accounts are doing well in the United States because those assets have gone up, up, up with the market or whatever they own, precious metals, whatever they own. And they are affluent. They are not wealthy. They don't perceive themselves as wealthy. They don't have four cars. They don't have two houses. They have a house and a mortgage, and it's got value, and they perceive themselves as secure. And Democrats are coming for them, Byron.
That's correct, because they're, I mean, the one of the big, maybe the biggest debate in tax policy for generations now has been, what is the definition of rich? And of course, if you ask Americans, they have all sorts of different definitions themselves. They put a different dollar value on it, a different wealth or net worth value on it. So nobody actually agrees on that. But Democrats have consistently said they have to lower the definition of what is rich so that they can continue to say that they are taxing the rich because of the people we all think of as mega rich, the Bezoses and the Zuckerbergs or the Warren Buffetts of the world. That's one thing. But there's no way to finance the programs without going after people. And they're going to end up going after people who make $200,000, $300,000 a year.
Even less. I think it was Willie Sutton who said he robbed banks because that's where the money is. And I believe that the affluent are going to get taxed because that's where the money is. Now, they may try and hide it by making it an inheritance tax and expand it. The stepped-up base is the most noxious, snake-like, absolutely tricky thing, because if you do away with a tax rule that's been there for 100 years, my friend Hank Adler, who teaches accounting, retired from Deloitte, says it will destroy the American upper middle class completely. They'll have to sell all those houses, sell family businesses. People don't know it, but I think they do, Byron. We got 10 seconds. Do you think they understand what's coming? The targets?
They understand, and I think we're going to see that in 2022. I just absolutely do.
Byron York, always a pleasure. Follow me at Byron York. Follow me to the next segment, America. I'm the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Brought to you by relieffactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on relieffactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show, at the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because relieffactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because relieffactor.com actually works. I carry in curcumin and resveratrol omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that 3-week starter pack, $19.95.